It is Thursday, November 15th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas. The Circle of Life Hospice presents its 12th annual gala, Voyage to a Dream. It's this Saturday, beginning at 6:30. This fundraiser will be held at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers. It will feature dinner, dancing, auctions, and more. Tickets and information are available at voyageforhospice.com.
Support for KUAF comes from Pilates Plus, offering Pilates mat and equipment classes, plus private instruction with comprehensively trained instructors. Massage, yoga classes, and Pole Place Fitness Studio are also available. More information is available at PilatesPlusNWA.com or 287-4519.
Ahead on Ozarks, Senator Mark Pryor discusses the road to the fiscal cliff. The University of Arkansas Wind Symphony and Symphonic Band join forces for a semester-ending concert. And Eureka Springs makes history when it comes to marriage equality.
But first, today, Governor Mike Beebe presents his proposed budget to lawmakers. It's expected to include cuts to Medicaid. Yesterday, he told members of the State Chamber of Commerce, expanding Medicaid in accordance with the federal health care law is the best way to shore up a gap in funding for the program. The governor made his remarks before the chamber's annual meeting. He says he's willing to look at other options, but compared passing on federal money for expanding Medicaid coverage to passing on federal highway dollars.
I don't want to leave Arkansas out. Don't send my highway money to California. Don't send my highway money to New York. And don't send my Medicaid money to Illinois and leave my people and my hospitals and my doctors and my employers and my folks in Arkansas out.
The governor also says adopting the Medicaid expansion would help avoid cuts to nursing home care for seniors provided by the program. Department of Human Services officials have said that they could save the state $35 million by cutting the lowest level of nursing home care.
A new proposal from the U.S. Air Force would see the 188th Fighter Wing in Fort Smith lose its flying mission. Yesterday morning, Fort Smith city leaders received word that the latest Air Force proposal calls for a return of two A-10 Warthog units, which are slated to go to operations in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Selfridge, Michigan, both bases that were originally slated to lose the Warthog missions as well. Tracy Winchell is the communications director for the city of Fort Smith. She says that what some leaders in the community and in Washington fail to understand is that the A-10 mission is still new to Fort Wayne, but the 188th is fully accustomed to the Warthogs.
Fort Wayne has never been to combat in the A-10s. They converted from the F-16s, where on the other hand, we have been to combat twice in the last 7 years in the A-10. Our first tour of duty and our conversion to A-10s was so stellar that the Air Force itself in 2010 gave this unit its second highest award for outstanding service in the Air Force Outstanding Unit Award. And so now then they're telling us that these other units are better than we are and deserve to be around longer than we are.
Winchell says that if bases are losing flying missions in the name of budget cutting, cutting the mission for the 188th makes little sense, considering the unit's field-proven efficiency. About 250 to 300 people are employed full-time by the Air National Guard at the base, and there are about 1,000 traditional National Guard troops attached to the unit. Guard members who live in Fayetteville, Mena, Russellville, and elsewhere across northwest Arkansas. Although the unit has more than $100 million annual impact on the area economy, Winchell says that standing up for the troops who have just returned from an overseas mission is more important than stressing any economic impact that losing the Warthogs would have.
We believe that what we're doing in standing up for this unit is the most patriotic thing that we as a community can do for our nation. In 2005, the chairman of the BRAC Commission came to visit, and he said, the Air Force got this wrong. The Pentagon got this wrong. Our nation is safer when planes are on the ramp in Fort Smith, Arkansas. So here we are standing up again, and this is about national security and cost efficiency.
Winchell says that the only hope the 188th has for retaining its flying mission is if the message military leaders receive is one of the unit's cost efficiency, rather than the economic impact cutbacks would have on the area's economy.
Some schools in Washington County earlier this week received state money to help boost outdoor recreation programs for students. The county received more than $12,000 in Act 799 money from the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. The money comes from fines and fees levied by the commission in the county. Wayne Blankenship is the grants administrator for Washington County. He says the decision of which schools receive the money is not an issue taken lightly.
We look at, as a committee, at one time we all sit down and talked about it and discussed that we want to utilize the money as hard as we can to buy tangible stuff, rods, reels, and all kinds of fishing stuff, supplies.
Schools in Fayetteville, Springdale, Lincoln, and Greenland will all receive a piece of the funding pie. That money goes toward funding programs such as Hooked on Fishing, Not on Drugs, or to the National Archery in the Schools program. Also during the meeting, the Finance Committee decided to pursue state grant funding to help the Lincoln Rural Fire Department build another fire station in the Summers community west of Lincoln.
Actually, it's a block grant, and it is actually money awarded to the state from HUD. And with that, then each different fire department or whatever can apply to get money to buy fire equipment, build fire substations, and stuff like that.
The county helped the department apply for the same grant last year, but because the Lincoln Department was already awarded a different grant last year, it was ineligible to receive additional money to build the new station.
For those of you living in Franklin County who love festivals, you're in luck, as a new festival is debuting next year at Mulberry Mountain. Pipeline Productions, the company responsible for the Wakarusa and Harvest Festivals, announced yesterday that the first Thunder on the Mountain Country Music Festival will be held June 6th through the 8th at Mulberry Mountain. If that date seems odd, it's because the festival is scheduled for the weekend following Wakarusa. While Wakarusa and Harvest Fest tend to fit more in the jam band paradigm, Pipeline Production claims that Thunder on the Mountain will offer a top-notch lineup of the best country music artists out there. In addition to the usual camping, vendors, river floats, fishing, waterfalls, hiking, and more. Expect the band lineup and ticketing information to be released sometime next month.
The Watershed Sanctuary Project at Cave Springs is receiving a bit more assistance. According to thecitywire.com, Cargill is donating $50,000 to the Illinois River Watershed Partnership for development of the sanctuary, which the partnership hopes will serve as a watershed education complex for Northwest Arkansas. Some clouds tonight, some overnight fog as well, lows around 30 in Northwest Arkansas. It will be clear in the Arkansas River Valley tonight with a low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, clear, highs in the low to mid-60s. And for Friday night, clear, lows in the lower to mid-30s. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On the phone with me from Washington, D.C., Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor. We're going to talk about the fiscal cliff. First of all, welcome back to Ozarks at Large, Senator.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. And it's always great to be here.
We are a few weeks from, as many pundits have said, going over the fiscal cliff. There has been some opinion of late that this is perhaps not as dire a situation as some have said. I'd like to know your opinion on how serious it is and how likely it is that we'll meet that fiscal cliff.
Well, I think it is a very serious problem, and I think that the objective people who've looked at this say that if we go over the cliff, we're going to trigger a recession. We're going to go back to probably 9% unemployment, and we're going to slow down the economy, and it's not going to be good, because the combination is you're going to dramatically cut federal spending while at the same time you're going to increase taxes. It's just a bad combination for this economy, and we don't need to do it.
Do you get a sense of immediacy on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This week, we've been here all week, and this week what's kind of happened, honestly, is the Republicans, I think, are in a little bit of a funk. I think that a lot of them thought they would win the White House, and they thought that they might even take control of the Senate, but the opposite happened. The Democrats won the White House, and Democrats added two seats in the Senate. So I think they have spent this week trying to get their bearings and trying to sort out what this really means and how to go forward. And I'm not being critical of them, because, you know, everybody kind of gets there sometime where you just need a little time to digest it all. I understand that. Problem is, we just don't have a lot of time here. We're really need to do something important before the end of the year. So if we just kind of pretty much lost this week and then we have Thanksgiving next week, I mean, we really don't have very many weeks left for us to really get this done.
The president has called for extending tax cuts for the middle class. The possibility of that happening?
I think you're going to see a combination of things on taxes. And let's talk about the president's statement just for a moment. You know, he comes out and he talks about we need to extend the middle class tax cuts, but we need to increase the taxes on, you know, millionaires, basically, 250 and above and millionaires. Well, the problem is, if you look at the numbers, you could actually increase taxes on millionaires to 100% tax rate. I mean, you could tax every dime they make. You still don't balance the budget. So we need to be realistic about what we're talking about here. We're going to have to do tax reform, but we have to do it in such a way that we do reduce the deficit and reduce the debt. But at the same time, we need to protect our economy. We need to protect the middle class and seniors and our national security interests. So it's going to be a balancing act, and it's going to be a hard one to do. And I guess my view, probably the most likely situation, is we need a long-term solution here. You know, I've been pushing for Simpson-Bowles for 2 years now, that at least we use that as a starting point and use it as a framework. But I think realistically, here we are at the end of the year, I don't think we get all of this passed in the next, you know, 6 weeks. I think we're probably going to have to do something short-term and then a mix of things and carrots and sticks maybe a little bit over the course of the next year to get this done. But we cannot kick this down the road. I think we kick this down the road, we're going to be clobbered by the markets, and I think we're going to be clobbered by our allies overseas and everything else. People all over the world want America to lead. They need America to lead. And this is not the way to do it, by kicking it down the road.
What role will conversations about entitlement programs play?
Oh, I think entitlement programs have to be part of the conversation. I think we need to look at we need to fix our entitlements. The problem is, if you look at entitlements, and the big ones that people talk about are Medicare and Social Security, but the truth is there's dozens other entitlement programs. They all add up, and they all add up to big money. We need to reform those, and we're just going to have to. They're not sustainable right now. I mean, you know, it may not be pretty, it may not be fun. The truth is, you have about a 20 or so year bulge in a big curve, in the kind of a bell-shaped curve that's moving through the population, and it's called the baby boomers. The baby boomers are now hitting those ages where Medicare and Social Security are for them. And it's going to take about 20 years. We're going to need more revenue to work on that for the next 20 years. I mean, we just are. And we can't put our head in the sand and pretend like it's not happening. So, you know, there are a lot of hard decisions, a lot of reality needs to sink in around here, and we'll just try to get it done the best we can. And I think the best thing we can possibly do is work together in a bipartisan way to get it done.
Okay, what I'm about to say may be horribly naive.
Yes.
But we're as far away from an election cycle as we almost can be.
Yes.
This would seem to be, perhaps, even cynics might say, this seems to be perhaps the best time on a calendar that you could have Democrats and Republicans working together.
I agree with that, because you have some people leaving and they don't really have a stake in the future anymore. I mean, in politically anymore, right? Yeah?
Yeah.
I get that.
So is that reason for hope that this could be some bipartisan work?
I think there is hope on that, and I think that kind of what I would say is that we have a moment here where we can do some things that may not be possible after the first year. We may not have enough time, for example, to do tax reform.
Right.
To really do that and do it right, you probably really have to spend 6 months at least on it, maybe a year. I mean, you really, you know, it's complicated. As we all know, the tax code is very complicated. And every time you move the needle in one direction, you get people in your office saying, wait a minute, you know, don't touch a charitable deduction. You know, the University of Arkansas needs that, or UAMS needs these, they need these doctor slots down there so they can do residencies, and that's based on, you know, tax code and Medicare code and things like that. So it gets real complicated real fast. So realistically, you probably can't do it all right now, but I think you can set it up to where you pretty much have to do it next year. And I think there are ways to do it. I really do. And, You know, I've been talking to my Democratic and Republican colleagues all week up here. I've been having meetings with them. I've been grabbing them on the floor, been phone calls with them. Been very constructive. No one really has the magic solution yet. But I'm going to tell you, if you just keep talking and keep working on it, that's how you get it done. So I'm part of that process. I'm trying to talk, trying to work, trying to find common ground, trying to arrange things and push for things and have meetings and all that stuff. So, you know, I want to be part of the solution here. And, you know, that's kind of really been my forte since I've been in the Senate, is reaching across the aisle and working across party lines and just, you know, not worrying about getting the credit, just getting it done. And, you know, I'm hoping we have a moment where we can do that over the next few weeks.
Could this be a situation where, you know, New Year's Eve afternoon, New Year's Eve, there's still work being done?
Yes, and absolutely. In fact, a few years ago, we went to Christmas Eve, and we had a vote. We may have had a vote one year on Christmas Day morning, but I think it was Christmas Eve morning, and then even one other time since I've been here, we went up to like the 23rd of December. So the answer is yes, we can do that. We can come back right after Christmas and go to the very end of the year and get something passed on New Year's Eve. And the truth is, human nature being what it is, everybody works better with a deadline, right? That's just the way it is. If we gave the Senate Finance Committee 6 months to do this, on the 11th hour of the sixth month, they would be doing it. You know, they would finally get down to actually doing it. And that's just the nature of it. And that's okay. But that's why we can't, that's why we have to have some sort of hard, real deadline to make us get this done.
Senator Mark Pryor, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's good talking to you.
On some days, the violence in Syria is as bad as Iraq at its worst. On some days, more than 10,000 people flee across the border. Now, a new opposition coalition gets an immediate vote of confidence from France and maybe weapons as well. I'm Neil Conan. Syria's rebels, the refugees, and options for a reelected President Obama. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation, just after Ozarks at Large at 1 here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Eureka Springs on Monday night made history as the first city in Arkansas to pass a resolution in support of marriage equality. It's also the second city in the United States to endorse such a decree. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Clerk of Established Quorum.
Clerk of Raphael.
Here.
Ken Palnoff.
Here.
Karen Lindblad.
Here.
James DeVito.
Here.
Lady Balance.
Toward the end of Monday night's four-hour-long city council meeting stuffed with business, the five aldermen present heard the reading of a special resolution by Eureka Springs City Clerk Ann Armstrong.
Whereas the U.S. Supreme Court has held more than a dozen times that marriage is the key right of the American people, and in the 1967 landmark case...
Carroll County Quorum Court District 3 Justice of the Peace Lamont Ritchie authored the resolution, but it was Michael Walsh, a civil rights organizer and resident of Carroll County, who initiated it.
It conveys no legal rights or benefits, that's for sure. That's prohibited under the Arkansas State Constitution. So the best we could do was simply to get an endorsement from city officials that they believe in marriage equality as the right of all Arkansans and Americans.
Michael Walsh decided to take this step after learning that the city of Austin, Texas, had in late September passed a marriage equality resolution.
Well, I contacted the two city council members that I thought would be more likely to introduce such a resolution. One was James DeVito, the other was Lady Balance. They're often on opposite sides of the issues, of any issue. So I thought if I could get one from each camp, it would improve our chances of getting the resolution passed.
Michael Walsh had no idea going into this what flack the resolution might draw from council, comprised of both liberals and conservatives, but in the end, it was quietly accepted with no discussion.
There was absolutely no opposition. No one was there to speak against it, which was gratifying. And once the vote was taken, the city council simply broke for a few minutes to get some rest because they had had a long meeting. And they started congratulating me and Lamont for bringing the resolution to them.
Walsh also came to the meeting armed with petition signatures collected over the past several weeks.
We collected more than 750 signatures of supporters, both Eureka Springs residents and visitors who happened to be in town over the last week or so. They were from 59 communities in Arkansas and 15 other states. And that really gave us a good indication, just like last week's national election, that there was widespread support for marriage equality in Eureka Springs.
Among the signers was State Representative Kathy Webb, a Democrat and the only out legislator in Arkansas. Webb is term limited and chose to not run for reelection. She declined also being interviewed for this report.
I'm James DeVito. I'm the chef owner of DeVito's Restaurant, along with my wife, Teresa, in Eureka Springs.
But Eureka Springs Alderman James DeVito, who co-sponsored Eureka Springs Marriage Equality Resolution Monday night, was glad to talk.
You know, I see it as the last vestige of discrimination in America, and it needs to be addressed and rectified.
James DeVito, by the way, will serve another four-year term, having been reelected to Eureka Springs City Council. And he says Eureka Springs is being swept up into a new era.
I think Eureka Springs is a microcosm of the United States as a whole, that you're seeing with states passing marriage equality amendments and defeating initiatives to outlaw gay marriage, that we're truly reflecting the nation as a whole, that we're starting to understand the error of our ways and seeking solutions to bring everybody to the table.
And the table is growing larger, with various polls showing slightly more than half of all Americans now in support of marriage equality. This election cycle, voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington supported ballot measures affirming marriage equality. In Minnesota, they rejected a proposal to amend the state constitution to ban gay marriage, which is what we have here in Arkansas. In Wisconsin, voters elected the nation's first openly lesbian U.S. senator, and Arizona, New York, Wisconsin, and California elected four openly gay individuals to Congress. But this was not the first time Michael Walsh has worked to influence local politics in favor of gay civil rights. He's author of Eureka Springs Domestic Partnership Registry, the only one in Arkansas, which has been targeted for destruction by conservative state legislators on numerous occasions.
Well, the domestic partnership ordinance was passed in 2007 by the city council at that time. So over the past 5 years, it has brought in 612 couples who have obtained a domestic partnership certificate. It's contributed $21,000 to the city treasury and hundreds of thousands of dollars to the city economy.
Domestic partners include both same-sex couples and unmarried opposite-sex couples. Benefits offered to domestic partners can include health and long-term care insurance, group life insurance, bereavement, and sick leave. But how many municipalities have passed marriage equality resolutions? We consult Catherine Oakley, Legislative Counsel for State Municipal Advocacy at the Human Rights Campaign Fund, based in Washington, D.C.
You know, it's a very interesting question, and it's a relatively recent phenomenon. At this point, I know of two off the top of my head who have expressly passed a resolution in favor of marriage equality, and those are, of course, Eureka Springs and also Austin, Texas.
But with no mandate behind such a decree, why are they important?
There are a couple reasons why they're so important. I mean, they're really exciting because they demonstrate that people across the country recognize the importance of marriage equality. Even though some states may have a long way to go before they achieve marriage equality, people all across the country are recognizing that same-sex couples should have the same opportunities and that they're willing to stand up for that.
Catherine Oakley believes one practical effect is actually critical to saving lives.
And HRC released a report earlier this spring that showed 4 in 10 LGBT youth surveyed said they had heard negative messages about being LGBT from their elected leaders. And this is obviously the opposite and makes a really huge impact for young people who are hearing that instead of hearing negative messages, they're hearing that they live in a community that welcomes and supports them.
As for Michael Walsh, who quietly pushed this resolution through Eureka Springs City Council, it's a sign.
It's hugely symbolic that two cities in two red states, meaning Austin, Texas, and Eureka Springs, Arkansas, can even pull something like this off. That's pretty remarkable.
Of course, the final arbiter of equal marriage rights is the U.S. Supreme Court, which is supposed to consider a federal constitutional challenge to the U.S. Defense of Marriage Act, banning same-sex marriage. Its case review order list is pending November 30th. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Thursday, November 15th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
What a great title for a book. Beware of Limbo Dancers.
Roy Reed.
Roy Reed. If you don't know Roy Reed, he taught all of us of an age at the University of Arkansas who were studying journalism, worked for the New York Times forever.
Yes, he covered the southern United States during the Civil Rights Movement. Later was the London bureau chief and also had the White House as a beat for a while.
And now he has a book called Beware of Limbo Dancers, and he'll talk about it at 6:30 tonight at the Fayetteville Public Library.
And early in the book, he explains where the title comes from.
I was going to ask, where does this title come from?
It's a bit of graffiti that he saw somewhere.
Okay. Now, there are some tough choices tonight. Also at 6:30, Theater Squared hosts its Gala for Education at Mermaids in Fayetteville. And the MCs for the evening, the hosts, will be Lucy Arnaz and her husband, Lawrence Luckenbill.
Lawrence Luckenbill, a Fort Smith native and a U of A grad.
And, of course, Lucy is the daughter of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Mm-hmm. So call Theater Squared to find out about that. Eileen Ivers performs tonight at 7 o'clock at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Performed with Riverdance, performed with Cherish the Ladies. She's an Irish fiddler. 7 o'clock. Tickets start at $10. And there's a talk by Michelle Rathgaber tonight at the Mass Science Building at the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith. I would love to go to. She's going to talk about what's going on in archaeology in the River Valley. The title is Gouges All, Spearheads and Weaving Shuttles.
All things I assume you might be able to find?
Or things that we don't know what the, I don't know. It's one of those weeks. But her talk is at 7 o'clock in room 211 of the Mass Science Building, and it is free.
Okay.
Busy Thursday. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is W. Dale Warren from the University of Arkansas. And you are here with me at the – first of all, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Kyle.
You're here in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio because this is the time of the semester, just before finals for students, where the final symphony and wind band concerts take place.
You got it. We're hitting the home stretch finally.
But it strikes me that you don't even – your year is so compact, your semester is so compact, you don't really think about the home stretch.
Well, I mean, certainly not, because you're right. The schedule is intense from here till commencement in the spring even. And then the summer programs are, you know, week to week. So we don't really ever stop. That's true.
But on Monday night, November 19th, the final concert of the semester.
That is correct. You're going to get both the symphonic band and the wind symphony on stage the same evening. You're even going to get those two groups combined for a number.
Right, and we have something that had originally been scheduled earlier in the year, but then you kind of did some adaptation, right?
Well, we started on the Wind and the Lion for the first concert at midterm, and that's one of the most epic movies, if you know that film at all. And it just didn't work with the wind ensemble, you know, one on a part. And we needed more sound. We needed more energy and more intensity. So, you know, we came up with the idea, hey, put both groups together. They rehearse at the same time, just in different spaces. And now on Fridays, we have what the students have dubbed Mega Band. And Mega Band is going to play Wind and the Lion. So we're going to have 90-plus musicians on the stage. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Well, before we talk about that, the evening on the 19th, we'll start with a symphonic band.
Gustav Holst, yeah. Second Suite for Military Band and F, which is one of our major staples. Second major piece that Holst wrote for the wind band, and of course it came out 2 years after the E flat, which was 1909. This one in 11, but it didn't get played till 22, so nobody even knew about it for about 11 years after he wrote it. But the coolest thing about it and between it and the First Suite is the First Suite is all original music by Holst. In the Second Suite, only the first two measures are written by Holst, and the rest of it is basically English or British or UK folk songs.
The third movement, Song of the Blacksmith, you hear the blacksmith in there.
Oh, absolutely. The anvil is very right. present because the percussionist that plays the anvil is the blacksmith because he's using a big blacksmith hammer. I mean, there's no sparks and fire,
right.
But everything else is very authentic. It's just like you were in the blacksmith shop back in that time period where you're getting your horse's shoe worked on.
And so that's beginning. I should say, it starts with Holst. This is an all-star composer.
Oh, absolutely.
That you have. I mean, Brahms and
sure.
and Copland.
I mean, he's one of England's finest without question. But, I mean, you know, he wrote The Planets, and that's what he's right. the most noted for. But he has a ton of great wind band repertoire as well as orchestral, piano, vocal. I mean, he wrote for all genres.
Then you have Brahms.
Then we have Brahms. It's hard to beat Brahms. You know, he's one of the three German Bs, you know, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. And he wrote the German Requiem in German, not in traditional Latin, which was very unique for its day. And then Barbara Buhlmann extracted the opening called Blessed Are They That Mourn. Well, the text is Blessed Are They That Mourn. And it's just a stunning remembrance of one that is no longer with you.
On stage for that performance is Michael Moon, who's the graduate conductor.
He's one of four.
Right. What do you tell a graduate conductor? I mean, do you remember back when you were a graduate
well,
conductor?
Well, sure. It was only, 100 years ago. But, I mean, Michael's in his second year, and he's one of our stars. He's a rock star. You don't have to tell Michael a lot. Michael's got an IQ of a million. Mm-hmm. He's a hard worker. He can't say no to anybody. That's his problem, if he has one. But, you know, he's very sensitive. He gets it. And this piece for him is a beautiful fit because he's a very lovely, eloquent, expressive conductor, and that's what this piece needs.
Then intermission, and then comes The Wind and the Lion. Jerry Goldsmith, who's an Oscar winner, he won an Oscar for The Omen.
He did.
But he was nominated for this score.
That's correct. Yes. That's very good.
And this is sweeping.
You always blow me away with everything you know. Well, it is an epic. I mean, it's panoramic. It's yeah. Montana. Oh, it's Morocco, of course. It's Northern Africa, set in the early 1900s. But it's when I saw the film, I was a senior in high school. It came out in 1975. That's my senior year. And I couldn't get over the cinematography, and I didn't even know what that word was then. But, you know, there's no CG then.
Right.
It's all real. Horses are running full
right.
tilt. They're falling down, throwing their riders. I mean, it's the epicness of the desert and, you know, the Atlantic Ocean and the Aborian Sea? I guess it's on the other side there. Mm-hmm. And so it's – I mean, every scene is just a stunner. Your jaw drops, go, I got to go there. I've got to go see this place. This can't be for real. But the music is so exciting and so romantic and so heart-wrenching. I mean, you want those tribesmen to get their land back from the British. I mean, you know, you're pulling for them. So it's a very emotional movie score, and the students are really getting into it.
After that, oboes. Oboes kind of the instrument that's going to take us through the rest of the show. You concerto for two oboes and band. You have Cheryl and Teresa.
Right. Well, it's oboe mania on yeah. campus. You know, November has been oboe mania month now for a long time. So we thought, well, why not just do the whole thing oboe? And, you know, Bob Mueller's doing oboe. It's his guest artist mm-hmm. on the USO concert coming up. So it's an oboe fest. There's no question. But Cheryl's in town for oboe
mania. Oregon.
Right, from Oregon. And, you know, she's a world-class player. And so we thought, well, we've got these oboes in town. Why not use them? So I didn't even know the Albinoni. I started talking to Tess Elaplane about what would be appropriate for, oboes and wind band. And she came up with the Albinoni, and I go, you know, he's pre-Bach. You know, this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's 14 years older than Bach, but it sounds like Bach. I mean, you would swear Bach wrote it. And it's delightful. I mean, it's three completely different movements, but every one of them in the great Baroque career, you feel like, here's a harpsichord moment, and then, you know, here's an organ moment. And it's just terrific. And the oboe parts are just insane. They're great.
Insane because?
Difficulty. There's so much black. And But Tess, you know, I just came from rehearsal, and Tess sounds like $1 million. I mean, it's going to be great.
Tess, most people who follow music around here know Tess Dalton.
Sure.
You have a faculty, Cheryl Denise Uricki, who is the other oboist. You
could Weffler say, is what now she goes by Denise Weffler now.
Oh, okay.
Married name, right.
Oh, Uricki Weffler, right. She literally wrote the book on oboe playing.
A couple of them, actually.
Yeah.
That's right. She did. Now, she's a terrific author, and everybody goes after her to make their reeds. She's a custom reed maker, not only to oboe, but English horn, and she's written the book on that as well. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't even have a good word to describe her because she does so many things well. But, you know, great player, author, reed maker, plays in all these different ensembles in Oregon, mm-hmm. You know, teaches, college professor. I mean, she just does everything.
Then there's some Aaron Copland, Down a Country Lane.
Ben Chamberlain's going to come out and do that. We're calling it our sorbet moment mm-hmm. between the oboes, you know, just kind of cleanse the upper palate. But you can't beat Copland. We needed something lighter, more beautiful, more tonal, you know, more melodic in this show because of how big the beginning and the end are. So that's why that's there.
Then they're back to oboe, Piazzolla. And something rather later for him, 1982.
Right, 10 years before he died.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's the tango master,
right.
as we all know. But, you know, Oblivion has become his big hit. Everybody knows Oblivion because it's a stunning piece. And, of course, you know, nobody in South America is bigger in the tango world than Piazzolla.
And so that's a fun piece to play, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's just gorgeous. It's marching. I call it the red hot tango. I mean, that's kind of the descriptor I have. It's the dancer. It's like Dancing with the Stars in their red dress and the guy in the tuxedo. And it's
right.
formal but fun and very close and very intimate. And it's hot. I mean, it you can't touch it with asbestos gloves kind of piece. Yeah, it's really neat.
And then you end with what I think is one of the most haunting pieces of music I've ever associated with a film, and that's the music from On the Waterfront, Marlon
right.
Brando, a very sad movie.
Very sad. Well, it's, you know, it's about union violence and corruption among longshoremen in New York,
and what could have been, and
all that,
yeah.
right? And you know, Brando delivers this incredible performance in it. I mean, and that's an all-star cast too: Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, Rod
yeah.
Steiger, Eva Marie Saint, 8 Academy Awards for that film. I mean, you know, it's just off the charts for 1954.
And then, of course, the music by Leonard Bernstein.
Right, the only movie score I ever wrote.
And it's
and they had
just,
to talk him into it.
Yeah.
You know, he turned it down the first time.
But it fits so well.
It's incredible. I mean, it's Bernstein, of course, and it's incredible music. And we finally got a version for the wind band just this past year, or just this past spring, actually. So we were just so thrilled that Jay Bill Cook took on that challenge. But I'm not kidding you. You don't miss the strings. It's that good. I mean, it's the best thing Jay's ever done, in my view. It's ridiculously good.
The University of Arkansas Symphonic Band and the U of A Wind Symphony will perform Monday night at 7:30 at Walton Arts Center. The concerts are the final performances of the semester for the ensembles. I talked with W. Dale Warren earlier this week inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at KUAF.
It's the scandal that proves the military intelligence complex is just like high school for belligerent people. Sexy emails, beautiful biographers, party planners with diplomatic immunity. Why Hurricane Sandy got so upset about being pushed out of the news, it started sleeping with its biographer. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me. Every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock on KUAF 91.3 FM.
It is Thursday, November 15th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Jody Beznoska, who is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hello.
I don't know if we can officially call this the holiday season, but we're darn close.
I think we're pretty much there. I mean, what is it, 2 weeks after Halloween? So
2 weeks and a day, yeah. and a week away from
Thanksgiving. A week away from Thanksgiving, and I think, what are they moving? They're moving all the Christmas sales up, and the music has started already, and Black Friday is going to be like Black Wednesday or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Now, the first thing I want to talk about with you tonight doesn't really have a holiday attachment, Eileen Ivers.
Yeah.
But this is going to be exciting as part of 10 by 10.
Yes.
She's a multiple Grammy winner.
Multiple Grammy winner. She has performed with all kinds of different ensembles, full symphonies, major rock stars. You know, she's kind of, she's pretty much awesome when it comes to playing an Irish fiddle. So, yeah.
I'm imagining there are still tickets left.
There are still tickets left. This one is on the 10 by 10 art series, so you can get tickets for $10. And I looked at the map just yesterday afternoon. There are great seats left.
Will you have the traditional 10 by 10 pre and post?
Yes,
activities?
We will have the pre-show conversation, and then we'll have the post-show little party in the lobby afterwards where you can share your feedback on the little sticky notes on the wall. And it should be a lot of fun. And it isn't holiday, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, when I hear sort of rollicking Irish music, kind of has that flavor to me.
I agree.
You think about, you know, a party, a gathering of friends, you know, that feels sort of holiday-ish.
So that's tonight.
That's tonight, and that should be at 7 p.m. tonight.
Should be.
Yes.
That's the schedule.
If all goes well,
right,
it will be at 7. Right.
And then Billy Elliot is approaching.
Yes,
have I skipped over something?
We did skip over two shows, but let's talk about Billy Elliot just for a little bit. Yes, Billy Elliot, second Broadway show of our season. It opens on December 4th and runs through the 9th, 8 performances. A very, very, really high quality, fantastic Broadway show that we haven't seen here in Northwest Arkansas. It's never been here before. And it's based on the movie. Mm-hmm. Great movie about a young boy who wants to be a ballerina.
Now, this is a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, because I've only seen the movie, do you know if any of the T-Rex music or the music from The Clash makes it into the Broadway?
I don't. You will probably hear themes, like similar themes, but it's all original music.
Okay.
And Elton John is the man involved with that music.
Okay.
So it will have an Elton John-ish feel to it. And in the the show won all kinds of Tony Awards. And I know we've talked a little bit about the interesting role of Billy in that he's a 12-year-old boy. He's on stage the whole time.
Right.
They travel with multiple Billies. Because the role is so demanding and they switch out. And so it's going to be a lot of fun to have them here. So if you obviously if you're a Broadway person, this is a show for you. But also if you like dance, a great show for you to see, because there's some really wonderful dance pieces in the show. And it's about a young boy who wants to find his passion, which is to dance. So.
And that's early December. What did I skip over?
We skipped over another 10 by 10 art series on November 29th.
Right.
It's called All is Calm, the Christmas Truce of 1914. It's by Cantus, which is an a cappella singing group, and Theatre La Te Da, which is theatrical.
If you know anything about Cantus, this is one of the most highly regarded a cappella ensembles in the world.
Yeah.
If you do
deal.
A little bit of research about a cappella music, those who truly follow it, this is like their Babe Ruth, their Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, these guys are good. and they're combining with a theater company, which that gets the arts geek in me all excited.
And this will be heavily holiday flavored because it's a true story of when, for at least a night, Christmas Eve, I believe it was, French and German soldiers put down the weapons, came out of the trenches in World War I.
And they sang Christmas carols together.
Yeah, it's going to be a goosebump kind of raising night.
It's 10 by 10.
Crazy.
Yeah. So that's on the 29th. Two nights later, we will have the Sean Jones Quartet in the Starlight Jazz series. Sean Jones is a trumpeter and apparently comes with a pretty energetic and fun band.
Yeah.
So there'll be two shows of that on the 1st.
Not a bad seat.
No, not in the Star Theater.
No, not even close to a bad
seat. No, Star Theater, you know, at the most it seats 170 people.
Yeah.
So if you buy one of the low price, you know, $11, $10 tickets, unbelievable, you can be, you know, 20 feet from.
You're putting the nonprofit in nonprofit.
Yeah, we
with
really
these
are. We really are. But we really want people to be able to see stuff. So we're trying as hard as we can to make that affordable. So we'll have Sean Jones on the 1st, Billy Elliot from December 4th through the 9th. And then we start this sort of full steam ahead holiday Christmas time. We'll have Mannheim Steamroller their Christmas show on December 11th. We will have a wonderful little show for little kids on December 14th. It's based on the books Guess How Much I Love You and I Love My Little Storybook, mm-hmm. a wonderful puppetry show, perfect for kids ages 3 to 6. And then we'll have Winona's Rockin' Christmas on December 16th. We'll have Jim Brickman on A Winter's Night on December 17th. And then we'll have the Preservation Hall Jazz Band Creole Christmas.
Oh, fun.
That is going to be so much fun. I mean, Preservation Hall, you can't not smile when you hear their music. And then you combine Christmas with it, and that's going to be terrific. So obviously I will see you at that one.
Yes, you will.
And then Moscow Classical Ballet will be here doing the Nutcracker from December 21st through the 23rd, right before Christmas. Perfect.
That's crazy.
Perfect timing. Yeah, that's going to be really great. There are 4 shows. Tickets for that one, there are plenty of tickets left, but they are going fast.
I bet.
So get those early. And then we will go dark for a little bit. Theater Squared will have their Christmas show called Period of Adjustment in this period.
Which is holiday themed.
It is holiday themed.
To some degree.
It isn't, from what I understand, it is not, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life or
it's
Christmas
Tennessee
Carol.
Williams, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's Tennessee Williams, but it's set on Christmas Eve and it has a theme of hope and redemption that goes along with that time of year. So they will have their concert. Also, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas will have their Christmas concert. On the, I'm going to hope I get this right. I think it's the 15th. It could be the 16th. We'll talk about that next week a little bit more. And also our other resident theater company, the Northwest Arkansas Community Creative Center, will be having a holiday bazaar, I believe, on the first and second of December.
Right.
It's going to be busy.
Yeah, it is.
In our buildings, which is really fun.
And I want to point Susan Hutchcroft, mm-hmm. who is the director. Mm-hmm. She made the awards for yesterday's National Philanthropy
Day.
Yes. They were beautiful.
I love that.
They were beautiful.
I love her stuff.
Yeah.
I have several of her little vases in my house. Yeah. So, yeah, her work is really great. So that's the Christmas lineup. And then if you are interested in purchasing tickets as a gift, that is such a good present. I mean, if my family was here, that's all they would get, would be mm-hmm. tickets to things. I have a couple of shows for you. The first would be Catch Me If You Can in January. This is right after the holidays. Starts on January 8th. This is a musical version of the DreamWorks movie starring Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. The musical does not star them.
No.
But it's a song and dance version of that really fun sort of con man chase mm-hmm. story. And then our next Broadway show after that will be Memphis in February. We'll talk a lot about Memphis, but it's probably one of the best shows I've seen in the last 3 or 4 years.
You told me.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So plenty of great gift fodder for you at Walton Arts Center.
Thank you, Jody.
Thank you. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 or stop by the box office and visit us.
All right. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you.
Jody Beznoska is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center. This is Ozarks at Large.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 15th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of Georgia O'Keeffe, the painter born Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, 1887. She lived in New York for a time. It was there she started to paint the enormous flowers for which she is best known. But she took a trip out to Taos, New Mexico, and she came to love the desert. She felt that the thin, dry air enabled her to see farther. And she devoted much of the rest of her career to painting desert scenery. Georgia O'Keeffe, who said, "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." It's the birthday of Marianne Moore, born Kirkwood, Missouri, 1887. Her father was an engineer and inventor, spent his life trying to build a smokeless furnace. When his business failed, he had a nervous breakdown. He had to go to an institution for the mentally ill. Marianne Moore was born just after her parents had separated, and she never met her father. She went to Bryn Mawr College, where she majored in biology, and where working in a laboratory had a profound effect on her writing. Marianne Moore, who said, "Precision, economy of statement, logic, drawing and identifying liberated my imagination." It was on this day, 1940, 75,000 men were called to armed forces duty under the first peacetime conscription in American history. The draft, never popular in America, In 1939, a poll had shown only 35% of Americans approved of a draft. But by 1940, with Hitler's army invading, occupying Poland and France, support for a draft had gone up to 92%. So in October of 1940, 16 million young men registered with the Selective Service, the first 75,000 draftees called up to service on this day in 1940. And it's the birthday of the poet Ted Barragan, born Providence, Rhode Island, 1934. Served in the Korean War, went to college, University of Tulsa, then went to live on the Lower East Side of New York City. In the early 60s, began writing his collection of 14-line poems called The Sonnets, which came out in 1964. It was a big success. Wrote the first six sonnets in one night, then wrote two or three per day for about 3 months. Here's a poem by Ted Barragan on his birthday, entitled Autumn's Day, after Rilke. Lord, it is time. Summer was very great. Now cast your shadow upon sundials. Let winds remind meadows it is late. Mellow now the last fruits on the vine. Allow them only two more southern days. Hasten them to fullness and press the last heavy sweetness through the wine. Who has no home cannot build now. Who dwells alone must now remain alone. Will waken, read, write long letters, and will wander restlessly when leaves are blowing. Autumn's Day, a poem by Ted Barragan from the collected poems published by University of California Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Wall Street Journal, with features written to help discover something new every day, including weekends. Subscriptions to the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition at wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Burnsville.
Burnsville? Where is Burnsville?
Well, I went to Boonville a couple of days ago to work on a story, and it's a town that I passed through on Highway 10 heading into Boonville, so Burnsville.
So you've been to Burnsville recently.
I drove through Burnsville.
Give all of us an idea of what Burnsville looks like.
Well, not much.
Okay. How far is Burnsville from Boonville?
About 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Burnsville. So 20 minutes west of Boonville.
Highway 10 is pretty.
It is pretty.
It's very pretty.
It is pretty.
And we'll hear that story from Boonville Monday, I believe.
Monday,
is what we've got scheduled. Thanks to the organizers of National Philanthropy Day in Northwest Arkansas for inviting me to be the MC yesterday for that event. Very inspiring, honoring philanthropists, young, not as young, from all over Northwest Arkansas. It was a great afternoon.
Good deal.
Let's see. Tonight is the gala for Theater Squared. As Becca told us, I mean, it's just crazy.
Right,
what's
very
going
busy
on.
Evening.
Yes,
I have a going away party for a friend. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh. And yesterday, I'm glad you brought that up. Yesterday, there was a going away party for Melissa Bluen, who has been a science writer at the University of Arkansas for 14 years. She's moving on to Florida. She will be greatly missed by the university and the media communities in Northwest Arkansas. I told her that there's a rule. There are certain people who are not supposed to leave Northwest Arkansas.
She's one of them.
Yeah, well, she's breaking that rule.
And then there was Ithy, too.
Exactly.
She broke the rule.
You're right. You're right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And tomorrow, Antoinette Grajeda will be with me. And you and I back together on Sunday morning, weekend Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9. you'll have a story about Fibonacci Day?
Yes. Yes, the Fibonacci sequence.
Right, and why that's important. And we'll have much more. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.